All right. And we are in 2 Samuel. 2 Samuel. We're going to be down in chapter 20, 2 Samuel 20. Since we weren't here last week, somebody helped me out, and did we cover the death of Abner or Amasa? Did we do that yet? Did we? Was that an uh-huh or an uh-uh? No? Okay. If Frank doesn't get it posted in time, I lose track of where I'm at, so. Huh? I didn't hear what you said. Oh, okay, so I ended up in chapter, okay, got it. All right, let's start with verse 4 then. 20, verse 4. Then said the king to Amasa, "Assemble me the men of Judah within 3 days, and be thou here present." Now that's because this Benjamite, a son of Belial back in verse 1, the Sheba, the son of Bichri, again a Benjamite, he has decided that he's gonna lead a little rebellion and not have the Israelites and the Benjamites particularly come in under David's kingship again. And so he has to take off, and the Lord, David calls on Amasa. Now, of course, that's giving Joab's job away. And like I said, David is fed up with Joab. And so he gives Amasa the job, "Assemble me the men of Judah within 3 days, and be thou here present." So Amasa went to assemble the men of Judah, but he tarried longer than the set time which had been appointed him. And David said to Abishai, so once again, going around Joab, this time to his brother. So in David's mind, Joab is out. He's fed up with Joab. And David said to Abishai, "And now call Sheba, Sheba the son of Bichri do us more harm than did Absalom. Take thou thy servants, Lord's servants, and pursue after him, lest he get him fenced cities and escape us." There went out after him Joab's men and the Cherethites and the Pelethites, all the mighty men, and they went out of Jerusalem to pursue after Sheba the son of Bichri. So the Cherethites and Pelethites are kind of hard to track down, but they're apparently like a servant warrior class, like some guys that are near the king and do some body service, kind of like a secret service type deal. But when it comes to a pinch, they'll take off and go fight. So that's the best I can do for you for Cherethites and Pelethites. They're not very well defined in the Word of God. They seem to be connected with the Philistines, so maybe another branch of the Philistines besides Ittai's group. Verse 8. When they were at the great stone, which is in Gibeon, Amasa went before them, and Joab's garment that he had put on was girded unto him, and upon it a girdle with a sword fastened upon his loins and the sheath thereof. And as he went forth, it fell out. And Joab said to Amasa, "Art thou in health, my brother?" said the spider to the fly. And Joab took Amasa by the beard with his right hand to kiss him. So there's a lesson to you guys. Don't be letting no guys kiss you. Verse 10, especially the guy with a sword in his hand. Verse 10. But Amasa took no heed to the sword. I mean, after all, Joab is a kinsman. And, they're on the same side, right? Only not, because Amasa's been given Joab's job, and Joab's going to kill him. So he smote him therewith in the fifth rib, shed out his bowels to the ground, and struck him not again, and he died. So Joab and Abishai, his brother, pursued after Sheba the son of Bichri. And one of Joab's men stood by him and said, "He that favoreth Joab and he that is for David, let him go after Joab." And so kind of picking teams. Verse 12, and Amasa wallowed in the blood in the midst of the highway. When the man saw that all the people stood still, he moved Amasa out of the highway into the field, cast a cloth upon him, when he saw that everyone that came by him stood still. And when he was removed out of the highway, all the people went on after Joab to pursue after Sheba, the son of Bichri. And he went through all the tribes of Israel. Now they're headed north, and he goes up unto Abel. So that's way up north. And to Beth-Maacah and all the Beerites, and they were gathered together and went also after him. And they came and besieged him in Abel of Beth-Maacah. They cast up a bank against the city, and it stood in the trench, and all the people that were with Joab battered the wall to throw it down. Then cried a wise woman out of the city, Hear, say, I pray you, unto Joab, come near hither, that I may speak with thee. When he was come near unto her, the woman said, Art thou Joab? And he answered, I am he. And she said unto him, Hear the words of thine handmaid. And he answered, I do hear. And then she spake, saying, They were wont to speak in old time, saying, They shall surely ask counsel at Abel. And so they ended the matter. I'm one of them that are peaceable and faithful in Israel. Thou seekest to destroy a city and a mother in Israel. Why wilt thou swallow up the inheritance of the Lord? And Joab answered and said, with doe eyes, with deer eyes, you know, far be it from me that I should swallow up or destroy. Said the spider to the fly. The matter is not so, but a man of Mount Ephraim, Sheba, the son of Bichri by name, hath lifted up his hand against the king, even against David. Deliver him only, and I will depart from the city. And the woman said unto Joab, Behold, his head shall be thrown to thee over the wall. Just plain as day. Real blunt. I wonder what they get out of the Hebrew with that. Then the woman went unto all the people in her wisdom, and they cut off the head of Sheba, the son of Bichri, and cast it out to Joab. And he blew a trumpet, and they retired from the city, every man to his tent. And Joab returned to Jerusalem unto the king. Now Joab was over all the host of Israel. So David had put Amasa pretty much in that spot, and now Joab's back because Joab killed Amasa, and David let him do it. So you kind of have a case here where Joab probably has leverage on David because he knows the secret about the murder of Uriah the Hittite, right? At least that's one thing. And he's shown he has some power over him anyway, and he's just a nephew. But still, David left him in. So Joab was over all the host of Israel, and Benaiah the son of Jehoiada was over the Cherethites and the Pelethites. And it iterates over and over again that Benaiah the son of Jehoiada was over that group of guys. And again, I think they're probably Philistines. They seem to be a servant class that also serve as warriors too. I'm not sure if it's like a secret service deal or what. Verse 24, and Adoram was over the tribute, and Jehoshaphat, the son of Ahilud, was recorder, and Sheva was scribe, and Zadok and Abiathar were the priests, and Ira also, the Jarethite, was a chief ruler about David. Verse 1 of chapter 21. All right, then there was a famine in the days of David, 3 years, year after year, and David inquired of the Lord, and the Lord answered, It is for Saul and for his bloody house, because he slew the Gibeonites. So I don't know if it took 3 years to inquire. It would take some people 3 years to start praying, but it was a three-year-long drought, and David finally got around to praying, or he did pray, and the Lord answered him directly. Okay, what is it about? It is for Saul, verse 1, and for his bloody house because he slew the Gibeonites. Well, first of all, Saul slew some Gibeonites. We're not given that incident, but Saul, somewhere along the way, when he was riding high on the wave, got overzealous and killed a bunch of Gibeonites, and there was a vow between the Israelites and the Gibeonites. But first, before we do that, so this bloodletting, that's something in the Old Testament that has to be answered. Look back to Genesis chapter 4. And in Genesis 4, go on down to verse 6. 4, 6. As you know, Cain killed his brother Abel. Okay, the Lord said unto Cain, why art thou wroth, and why is thy countenance fallen? If thou doest well, thou shalt thou not be accepted. If thou doest not well, sin lieth at the door, and unto thee shall be his desire, and thou shalt rule over him. So Cain talked with Abel, his brother. It came to pass when they were in the field that Cain rose up against Abel, his brother, and slew him. The Lord said unto Cain, where is Abel, thy brother? He said, I know not. Am I my brother's keeper? Sassy. And he said, what hast thou done? The voice of thy brother's blood crieth unto me from the ground. So with that comes the idea that when innocent blood is shed, that blood cries to God from the ground. Now, there's an argument for this being just applicable in Israel. Let me take you over to Genesis chapter 9 real quick. 9:6. Whoso sheddeth man's blood, by man shall his blood be shed, for in the image of God made he man. That would indicate that it may not be just in the land. And don't worry, I'm not leading you to a place where, you know, I'm going to tell you I don't believe in capital punishment. I'm just saying there's an issue specifically in the land as well. Look in Numbers 35. But no bones about it. You kill somebody, murder somebody in the Old Testament. In Israel, and that blood cried to God from the ground, and the only answer for you was death, because there was no sacrifice for murder. Numbers 35, 33. So ye shall not pollute the land wherein ye are, for blood, it defileth the land. The land cannot be cleansed of the blood that is shed therein, but by the blood of him that shed it. I only bring up the land part because in Israel, the land is a special issue. Now, how does this work in America? Well, for us in America, I mean, this is not holy ground or anything like that. But apparently the blood of somebody murdered still cries to God. Let me take you over and show you, in case you've been compromised by liberals. Let me take you over to Acts chapter 25. Acts 25. You don't really find a discussion in the New Testament about whether a murderer, say, should be killed, because it was understood that they should and that they would. There just wasn't a debate about it. Look in Acts 25. Now here's Paul. Paul 25:10. Then said Paul, I stand at Caesar's judgment seat where I ought to be judged. So the Jews, have I done no wrong, as thou very well knowest. For if I be an offender or have committed anything worthy of death, I refuse not to die. He said, so if I'm guilty of something worthy of death, then kill me. Okay? And let me take you over to Romans 13. It's understood. Don't misunderstand. I know that Christ was meek and lowly. I know that there's place for mercy. But as far as governments having the power to put somebody to death and an obligation to do so, God holds them accountable for doing so. Romans chapter 13. Numbers 13. Romans 13. Did I say Numbers? Romans 13. I'm sorry. It's been a long day. It's been a long week. Okay, 13:1. Let every soul be subject to the higher powers, for there is no power but of God. The powers that be are ordained of God. Whosoever therefore that resisteth the power resisteth the ordinance of God, and they that resist shall be received to themselves damnation. Now, we talked earlier last week about there being a damnation that's not unto death, unto eternity. But go on, for rulers are not a terror to good works, but to the evil. Wilt thou then not be afraid of the power, so that which is good, and thou shalt have praise of the same? For he is the minister of God to thee for good. Now, if you went to the Greek, you'd find that he was a deacon. I'm serious. It's the same word as deacon. But deacon means minister. The only time the Bible uses in the New Testament the word deacon is for the case of the church office. And it does it without being consistent in the Greek. The English made it consistent. Otherwise, you're confused. Because this guy here is a deacon. Anyway, verse 4, just so you know. Okay, for he is a minister of God. We're talking about a ruler. To thee for good, but if thou do that which is evil, be afraid, for he beareth not the sword in vain. What's the sword for? It's for beheading you. Like I'm saying, there's not a discussion in the New Testament, about whether capital punishment still applies or not, because it's the New Testament. It's understood that it is. And so it should be. Now, what you come to with that is, of course, you now live in a system here where nobody's put to death very often, but you also have a justice system that's corrupt down to its very toenails. And so, you know, it's not quite, I'm not so enthusiastic about the death penalty as I used to be. But ladies and gentlemen, there's atrocities that are committed. And one of the things that should happen for those folks when proven guilty, they should die within a week. Just take care of it in a week instead of waiting for 40 years through a system of 30 or 40 appeals before you finally pull the plug. Okay? I mean, if you want to know something that'll stop some crime, kill a criminal that deserves death within the week. Take care of it. You say, how will you do that? Line them up, shoot them, hang them, do whatever. Right? Well, you know, electrocute them, poison them to death, well, whatever. But take care of it. Anyway, all that's to say that the death penalty is still in vogue. Go back to 2 Samuel 21. So this is for Saul, for his bloody house, verse 1, because he slew the Gibeonites. Okay, now you should know what that's about. Go back to Joshua chapter 9. Joshua chapter 9. And the way this worked, of course, is Joshua has brought the people into the land, and he's defeating everybody right and left. And so verse 3, when the inhabitants of Gibeon heard that Joshua had done unto Jericho and Ai, they did work wilily, and went and made as if they had been ambassadors, and took old sacks upon their asses, and wine bottles old, and rent and bound up, and old shoes and clouted upon their feet, and old garments upon them, and all the bread of their provision was dry and moldy, and they pretended they'd come from a long way away, and wanted a covenant made. Well, Joshua didn't pray about it, made a covenant with them, and lo and behold, they live next door. And so by the time it's over, they've already done this covenant, and so they have a covenant with the Gibeonites. They've already had to be drawn into war for the Gibeonites in one case. And so at some juncture, we don't know the exact place, Saul in his zeal wound up killing some Gibeonites. And the Lord brought famine upon the land. Now, the interesting thing about that, folks, again, a social matter, is that that shows you that God takes care even in the case of servants, even in the case of bondsmen. Those Gibeonites were bondsmen unto the Israelites. And so the Lord will take vengeance for a bondsman's sake, just so you know. So there's justice even there. Back to 21:2. And the king called the Gibeonites and said unto them, now the Gibeonites were not of the children of Israel, but of the remnant of the Amorites. And the children of Israel had sworn unto them, and Saul sought to slay them in his zeal to the children of Israel and Judah. Wherefore David said unto the Gibeonites, what shall I do for you? And wherewith shall I make the atonement that ye may bless the inheritance of the Lord? Okay, now he's talking about the inheritance of the Lord. That is going to be, if you will, look in chapter 20, verse 19. We just covered it. This woman who pitched the guy's head over the wall, why wilt thou, verse 19, swallow up the inheritance of the Lord? She's talking about Israelites. Look in Deuteronomy 32. Deuteronomy 32. And go on down to verse 9. Deuteronomy 32, verse 9. For the Lord's portion is his people. Jacob is the lot of his inheritance. Okay? So the Lord's inheritance is Israel and the land she dwells on. verse, back to 2 Samuel 21 and verse 3, "Wherefore David said unto the Gibeonites, What shall I do for you? Wherewith shall I make the atonement?" Now there's that word used. It's almost always used in salvation. In this case, the atonement is a sacrifice to be made to appease God's wrath and to make things right with man as well. Verse 4, "And the Gibeonites said unto him, We will have no silver nor gold of Saul, nor of his house, neither for us shall thou kill any man in Israel. And he said, What ye shall say, that will I do for you. And they answered the king, The man that consumed us, Saul, and that devised against us that we should be destroyed from remaining in any of the coasts of Israel, let seven men of his sons be delivered unto us, and we will hang them up unto the Lord in Gibeah of Saul." Okay, here is the Gibeonites. Now, remember, Gibeah of Saul is a Benjamite city. That's Saul's hometown. So they're saying, give us the lives of seven of his descendants, and we're going to kill him and hang him up in his hometown on the wall. So it's pretty, pretty ironic, you might say the least. Back to verse 6. "We will hang them up unto the Lord now in Gibeah." You say, that's just bloody, just vengeance. Well, the Lord did use the word atonement. It was the Lord that struck them with a famine because this was done. And so they're hanging these guys up to the Lord, and the Lord accepts it for what it's worth. Right? Now, I'm not saying we should do that. Just saying, accept the Old Testament for what it says. Right? And you can thank God that there's only one man hung up that's necessary for us to be made right. Instead of all that's wrong done for us, somebody needs to be hung on a wall and made a spectacle for days for crows to eat their eyes out and stuff like that. Verse 6. "We'll hang them up to the Lord in Gibeah of Saul, whom the Lord did choose. And the king said, I will give them." So here's David, and he says, okay, I'll do it. Verse 7. "But the king spared Mephibosheth, the son of Jonathan, the son of Saul, because of the Lord's oath that was between them." So David's still a man of his word. I don't know if he's still mad at Mephibosheth or not. I don't know if he still doubts whether he deserted him or not. But whatever's the case, a vow is a vow. And Jonathan was much beloved by David. And so he kept that vow to Mephibosheth and kept him from being one of the ones hung up. Verse 7. That was between them, between David and Jonathan, the son of Saul. "But the king took the two sons of Rizpah, the daughter of Aiah, whom she bare unto Saul, Armoni and Mephibosheth." So the king took the two sons of Rizpah, the daughter of Aiah, whom she bare to Saul. So Aiah bare those two sons to Saul, and Mephibosheth, and the five sons of Michal, the daughter of Saul, whom she brought up for Adriel, the son of Barzillai, the Meholathite. Okay, there's a couple of things to untangle there. Go back to chapter 3, if you would. Chapter 3. And verse 7. "And Saul had a concubine," so she's a concubine, "whose name was Rizpah, the daughter of Aiah. And Ishbosheth said to Abner, Wherefore hast thou gone to my father's concubine?" So she was the one that got in this circle of accusation that there had been adultery committed. In the end, she's a concubine that bore two sons to Saul. So that much is clear. But the other five sons came from where? From the sons of Michal, the daughter of Saul, whom she brought up for Adriel. Okay, again, something to track down there back in 2 Samuel chapter 6. 2 Samuel 6. Second Samuel chapter 6, go down to verse 20. 23. So, as you'll remember now, Michal, the daughter of no child of Saul, rather, had no child until the day of her death because David had brought the ark of the Lord in, danced before it. She came in, said, you know, made a smart aleck remark. He said, no problem. He said, you and I aren't married anymore. And so he didn't go into her, and she didn't have a child all her days. So how come she's the one that brought up five sons for Adriel, the son of Barzillai? What's that all about? Go back, if you will. Let me make sure this is the one. 1 Samuel 18. And as it turns out, 1 Samuel, this is back when David is courting Saul's daughters. In verse 18, and David, so 18:18, 1 Samuel, David said unto Saul, who am I and what is my life or my father's family in Israel that I should be the son-in-law of the king? But it came to pass at the time when Merab, Saul's daughter, should have been given to David. Now he winds up marrying Michal, and then she winds up making fun of him, making a smart aleck comment about his dancing in front of the Lord. And so she was childless the rest of her life. But this Merab, in verse 19, it came to pass that when Merab, Saul's daughter, should have been given to David, that she was given unto Adriel the Maholathite to wife. So Merab was given to this guy, but according to the passage in 2 Samuel, where was I on that? 21 verse 8, she brings these five sons up for Adriel, who was Merab's husband. So the only thing you can come up with there is Merab must have died, and so Aunt Michal, you know, raised the boys. And those were five of the boys that were killed. Verse 9, and he delivered them into the hands of the Gibeonites, and they hanged them in the hill before the Lord, and they fell all seven together and were put to death in the days of harvest, in the first days, in the beginning of the barley harvest. And Rizpah, the daughter of Aiah, so Saul's concubine, the bearer of two of those sons, took sackcloth and spread it for her upon the rock from the beginning of harvest until water dropped upon them out of heaven. I'm informed that should be about 3 to 5 months, depending. So she's out here with seven dead bodies, two of which were her sons, and two of which were kinsmen. And she's driving off the crows and the buzzards for 3 months. Pretty brutal. And what's that about? That's all about one man's mess up, costing somebody that he presumably loved. Terrible, terrible price to pay, right? Because that's Saul's fault. Famine hits. What's going on? It's because of the death, what happened with the Gibeonites. So what do you guys want? We need seven sons. Two of them were this lady's sons. And so she stays out there and drives off the crows and the buzzards for 3 months. Brutal. But whatsoever a man soweth, that shall he also reap. Right? And this is years and years apart, the committal of the crime and this payment. So, again, sin has long-suffering consequences. It says, verse 11, and it was told David what Rizpah, the daughter of Aiah, the concubine of Saul, had done. And David went and took the bones of Saul and the bones of Jonathan, his son, from the men of Jabesh Gilead. They're the ones that rescued Saul and Jonathan's bones, which had stolen them from the street of Bethshan, where the Philistines had hanged them when the Philistines had slain Saul at Gilboa. And he brought up from thence the bones of Saul and the bones of Jonathan, his son. They gathered the bones of them that were hanged, and the bones of Saul and Jonathan, his son, buried they in the country of Benjamin, brought them back home in Zelah, in the sepulcher of Kish, his father, and they performed all that the king commanded, and after that, God was entreated for the land. So here's David still, long after Saul's dead, who is still honoring Saul, who spent half his life trying to kill David. So David's still doing the right thing by Saul. Verse 15, moreover, the Philistines had yet war again with Israel. David went down and his servants with him and fought against the Philistines, and David waxed faint. And Ishbibenob, which was of the sons of the giant. Now, pay attention to the giants here. Ishbibenob, which was of the sons of the giant. Notice it's the giant. The weight of whose spear weighed 300 shekels of brass and weight, he being girded with a new sword. I mean, 300 shekels of brass is, nobody's quite sure exactly how much. You get different things by going to different, different references. But that sword, that spear may have weighed 9 pounds. Now, I threw the javelin some in college, or tried to more than I threw it. But a javelin is, it's a track and field event. And that javelin only weighs a few hundred grams. Okay, it's not very heavy. Because the torque on, trying to throw the thing as far as those world-class throwers do throw them, the torque is horrendous. And so, just whipping it around. So if you were to put a 5-pound, make it weigh 5 pounds, the guy's going to rip his shoulder out. So if this, for instance, if this spear weighed 10 pounds, just imagine the size and strength of that dude. Okay? Verse 17, but Abishai the son of Zeruiah succored David, helped him, smote the Philistine and killed him. Then the men of David swear unto him, saying, thou shalt go no more out with us to battle, that thou quench not the light of Israel. And it came to pass after this that there was again a battle with the Philistines at Gob, where Sebekai the Hushathite slew Saph, which was of the sons of, again, the giant. And there was again a battle in Gob with the Philistines, where Elhanan, the son of Jair Oragim, a Bethlehemite, slew the brother of Goliath, the Gittite, the staff of whose spear was like a weaver's beam. And there was yet a battle in Gath, where was a man of great stature that had on every hand 6 fingers and on every foot 6 toes. Did I tell you this story from Malawi? Did I? I'll tell it again. So there. We were flying back from Malawi. I went back to the bathroom. It was the middle of the night sometime, and so I was standing back there waiting for that. Lady comes down the aisle with a kid that plainly needed to go to the bathroom. He's barefoot. So I'm thinking, ew, barefoot in a airplane bathroom. Ugh. Anyway, here he comes. And so I'm looking at his feet because I'm noticing that he's barefoot. 6 toes. 6 toes on each foot. He said, you counted? Yes. I even said this little piggy went to market thing on there, and I wound up with an extra toe. Seriously, 6 toes. He wasn't a giant, but it was just 6 toes. I don't think it's all that unusual, but it was just a moment for me in the middle of the night on a plane from Malawi, okay? Anyway, on every hand, 6 fingers, and on every foot, 6 toes. 24 in number. He also was born to the giant. Notice 3 times so far, the giant, the giant, the giant. Verse 22, these 4 were born to the giant in Gath and fell by the hand of David and by the hand of his servants. So, Goliath was a Gittite, okay? And when David went and got stones from the river to kill Goliath, how many stones did he get? He got 5 because Goliath had 4 brothers. And they were famous enough, apparently, because of their size. Now, it's interesting. I noticed a couple years ago that the Bible, we always talk about Goliath being a giant, but it never says he's a giant. It says that he and his 4 brothers were the sons of the giant. Okay? So apparently the giant might be bigger than these guys were, but it never calls Goliath the giant. Now this whole giant thing is kind of a big deal these days, and if you go, you can go look it up anytime you want to, and everybody goes to the Hebrew with it. Giants show up about 25 or 28 times. First three times they show up, the Hebrew word is Nephilim, and so you'll hear them referred to all the time as Nephilim. That only happens three times, the first three times it shows up. Look, if you will, and, I'm not going to take you into that, actually. So three times the giants are Nephilim, and then the rest of the times they're Rephaim. And again, that's all from Hebrew, and they draw all kinds of things from Hebrew and all that kind of stuff. What I actually think is that probably what that indicates is the original giants were there, and then they're the progeny of giants. I'm not really quite sure. But the Bible just calls them giants. The Bible calls the Anakims giants, the sons of Anak. That's who Israel saw in the land when they went up from Kadesh Barnea to spy out the land. The Emims are also giants. The Zamzumims are also giants. Og, the king of Bashan, was one of the remnant of the giants. Now he's over across the border over where Manasseh and those guys were across the river on the east side. And the valley of the son of Hinnom, which flows, which goes west from Jerusalem, was known as the valley of the giants. But that all shows up 25 or 28 times. Sometimes it's the valley of Rephaim, which means the word wasn't translated. But bottom line is what you should draw from giants is Nephilim, you know, they try to do all this stuff and figure out some spacey, mystical thing about the Hebrew meaning of Nephilim and Raphaim and all that stuff. Look, they're just giants. They came from where? Go back to Genesis 6. Genesis 6. Look, you're not benefited by going to the Hebrew. I'm just telling you that. Genesis 6. Verse 1, it came to pass when men began to multiply on the face of the earth and daughters were born unto them. Okay, that the sons of God, and there's all this debate and dispute about what this means. Well, it means the fallen sons of God, fallen angels, saw the daughters of men, that they were fair, and they took them wives of all which they chose. The Lord said, my spirit shall not always strive with man, for that he also is flesh, yet his days shall be 120 years. There were giants in the earth in those days. Okay, where did the giants come from? They are the progeny of offspring between fallen angels and the sons of men. And then presumably from the giants, then there was, you know, sequences through time where finally the giant we're reading about here apparently was the last giant. And that was all the way up in David's day. But there had been giants that they had defeated before, and they gradually killed them all off. Og of the Ammonites was one of the last of the giants. Apparently the giant in Gath was one of the very last giants as late as David's day. And so he had these sons, and they were big boys. And one had a spear that he could fling that was 10 pounds or more. They were big boys, but they were never called giants. So that's my take on the giants. All right, back to 2 Samuel 21. I did want to show you one other thing here. You'll notice something in verse 19. There was again a battle in Gob with the Philistines, where Elhanan, the son of Jair Oregim, the Bethlehemite, slew the brother of Goliath. Notice the brother of Goliath. What do you notice? Italics, right? Okay. So that, what does that really mean? 1 Chronicles 20. First Chronicles 20 and go on down to verse 4, where you have Sibbecai who slew Saphi, which is of the children of the giant. Verse 5, there's war against the Philistines, and Elhanan the son of Jair slew Lami, the brother of Goliath. What do you notice about that? It's not in italics, right? So the King James translators put it in italics in 2 Samuel, and it was right, right? Now those italics, ladies and gentlemen, are extraordinary things. You would have a tough time understanding the unknown tongues chapter without italics being in there. You go back through and try to read it sometime. But here's something that's very important to maybe keep in your artillery bag. 1 John chapter 2. 1 John 2. I didn't come prepared to do a big long thing on the italics in the King James Bible tonight, but suffice to say, without them, you would be confused many different times. And by the way, you say, well, I don't like it that the King James translators added words, but you don't mind that all the other new versions, editors added words, all kinds of words. So let me show you something. 1 John 2:23. Whosoever denieth the Son, the same hath not the Father. But he that acknowledgeth the Son hath the Father also. What do you notice about that verse? Fully half of it or more is italics. Okay, what does that mean? That means that the King James translators did not have a manuscript that had that reading in it when they translated the King James Bible. Okay? But they found one 200 years later that had the reading. I mean, the italics show that they didn't have a manuscript that read that. They added it. Okay? And they find one 150 years later that has it. How do you explain that? What led those guys? Now, again, 47 of them, whose names we know, you know, again, really smart guys, scholars. How do you get 47 guys to agree to a reading that's not there? Right? How do you do that? I mean, there's an argument for all that with agape phileo and all that kind of stuff, but how do you get 47 brilliant men who have their own pride issues, I'm sure, to agree to add words into a text that has no manuscript backing it up? I don't know. It has to be God. And then 150 years later, they find a manuscript that has it. In fact, I read one scholar, for what it's worth, who is for taking the italics out of verse 23, changing them to regular letters, because after all, we have manuscript evidence for it now. I say, no, let's just leave my italics. Proves the point, right? Okay, let's go back. Actually, rather than starting something else, we can just call it there. Any questions or comments? I know there was just a lot of reading tonight too. So, yes, sir, Brother Dave.